This is your Uncle Don, the direst of circumstances, back again with the 277th of my seemingly endless stream of porcupine petting zoo openings. I'm broadcasting from the spacious modern studio of CFUR in Prince George at 88.7 FM to those who forgot to turn off their radios after Democracy Now, and to Bradley, my grandson. I'm a guest on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet. While eyes are on the Olympic Games in Beijing, preparations in British Columbia are proceeding apace with our turn in the barrel 2 years hence. We may as well watch the development, as it is our money that's being squandered. For a cool $1 billion, contractors are literally moving mountains to assure that the yuppie highway between North Vancouver and Whistler will not force the rich to slow their BMWs as they commute between their condos in the two communities. Ostensibly to ease travel for 2 weeks of partying by tourists and athletes, this highway will be a lasting legacy, a gift to Liberal supporters paid for by the rest of us. And we must not forget that there are multitudes of terrorists plotting to disrupt Vancouver's Olympics. Well, there must be, as the U.S. Department of Homeland Paranoia now has no fewer than 1 million names on their ballooning list of dangerous terrorists. But have no fear, these terrorists will be met with armies of police, rent-a-cops, soldiers, and American flyboys. Yes, our skies will be patrolled by American Air Force fighters and drones, ever watchful for suspicious activities. On the ground, we'll have as many as 5,000 mounted police, drawn from the corners of Canada here to keep order while their home communities run short-staffed. Don't call 911 during the Olympics unless you live in Vancouver. No one will be answering. Lower mainland hotels will be stuffed with tourists and officials, so our Mounties will be accommodated in two chartered cruise ships at a tidy rent of $37,500,000. This is in addition to their 214 rooms reserved at the Blue Horizon Hotel in Vancouver. How sweet, or sweet, it is. These bills will be paid from the $175 million set aside in the budget proposed by the Olympic Organizing Committee years ago. Everyone knows that this will be pitifully inadequate for the security plan, with some estimating that the total could run to $1 billion. But not to worry. Premier Gordon Campbell pledged to use the provincial treasury to make up any shortfalls between estimated and real costs. The Olympic game round promises to be one that British Columbians will remember every time we pay our taxes for the next decade or two. Our provincial conservatives, billing themselves ridiculously as liberals, continued the dismantling of social structures that began with their likewise ridiculously named social credit predecessors. While there's some sniping between Gordon Campbell and Stephen Harper, their two administrations generally work hand in glove. Campbell claims to be taking BC on a green direction, while Harper's goal is to keep corporations in the black. Their disagreement over BC's carbon tax is a tempest in a teapot, causing barely a ripple in their love-in. Look at what Campbell's wreckers are doing to BC Hydro, a public corporation established in 1962 by a wiser social credit government than the one which began dismantling public services in the 80s. BC Hydro's mandate was to provide secure energy future for British Columbia. The Crown Corporation developed our province's hydroelectric potential, building the infrastructure that gives British Columbians some of North America's most reliable and inexpensive electricity. In the past, Hydro also provided natural gas distribution to the Lower Mainland, a function since given to a private corporation. It operated rail freight service onto Vancouver Island, later given to corporations. Until 1980, it provided public transit to Greater Vancouver and Victoria, a service still within the public sector only because it's not profitable. With 40 years' experience serving BC well as its core mandate of providing electricity to our citizens, our provincial Liberals decided to undermine its operations. Hydro was too successful in a field that private corporations lusted to invade. The public would not tolerate a frontal assault through full-scale privatization, so the Liberals adopted a new ploy. 6 years ago, they declared that Hydro was forbidden to develop any new generating operations. This field was to be left to the mercies of the private sector through insidious public-private partnerships, or PPPs, with independent power producers, or IPPs. But the destroyers love their acronyms. These IPPs are staking claims to our public streams and rivers so they can harness the energy of falling water. Their operations sound innocuous. They take the flow of water, divert it through a pipe, harness the electrical potential, and return the water to the same bed downstream. What harm could that do while people are provided with additional electricity? Lots. Construction of these IPP projects requires equipment that must be brought in. Pristine areas are open, forests felled, and roads built with attendant environmental destruction. Fish migration is disrupted, wildlife displaced, and paths open for vehicles. Transmission lines must carry the power to existing distribution lines, causing more trees to be felled and more areas open to human activity. Over 500 streams and rivers in BC have been staked by those seeking to appropriate their power. The applicant must obtain a water license, but the top price for such a license is $10,000, while the projected profits can run to millions. 35 private projects are already in operation, and another 45 proposals have received contracts. These Energy Purchase Agreements, or EPAs, another bloody acronym, run 20 to 40 years, committing BC Hydro to buy their output. After that, contractors will be free to sell their power to anyone, including the United States, leaving British Columbians having to outbid foreigners for power produced from our own flowing water. Contracts now being issued by Hydro pay more for these IPPs' power than Hydro is reselling it for to industry. Only ideologically driven fanatics could have come up with such a stupid way to squander public assets. And that isn't the end. The province will be paying up to $600 million to build the transmission lines connecting remote projects with existing distribution lines. A coalition of concerned organizations put out a flyer describing the effects of this government sellout entitled Power Grab, a copy of which I will leave with the PIRG office at UNBC. Their conclusion is as follows. The government's mad rush to develop private hydropower has resulted in a chaotic situation where cumulative environmental impacts are ignored, regional planning is non-existent, long-term energy security needs are undermined, and local governments have been silenced. Instead of public ownership of hydroelectricity, which serves the public interest, provides accountability and transparency, and returns hundreds of millions of dollars annually to provincial coffers, the provincial government has rolled the dice and decided to gamble, selling out the future of British Columbia's streams and rivers. The sooner we put the skids under these destroyers who are BC's current provincial government, the better. While British Columbia swings between fanatical privatizers and milder leftish parties, Alberta plods along with the same tired bunch of free enterprise, to hell with the future, quasi-conservatives. Is their democratic system serving the people of Alberta? That depends on who you count as the people. In March, the Conservative government of Alberta was re-elected, acquiring 72 of 83 seats in the legislature. This same right-wing bunch has run the province for 15 years, and we see the results. There's an uninhibited rush to exploit the tar sands with predictable consequences. Communities in the area experience rapid population growth without a commensurate expansion of government services. Water supplies and sewers are inadequate. Roads are beaten to rat shit by trucks, while the single narrow highway to Fort McMurray is a linear killing field on weekends. Those moving to northern Alberta find crowded schools, not enough housing, and overpriced everything. Then there's the unrestrained destruction of the boreal forest, massive lakes of poisons, polluted air, and a release of greenhouse gases that outpaces all but China in growth. Nice work. Governments at all levels are starved of funds as royalties on resources are ridiculously low, income taxes don't hit those tapping the wealth of the province, and they don't have sales taxes. And who keeps this negligent government in office? This last election saw only 41% of the electorate voting, the lowest turnout in Canada. Barely half of those cast ballots for Conservatives, meaning that only 22% of eligible Albertans chose representatives in an election that was billed as a landslide. Some landslide. As one Albertan commentator has said, the Conservatives ruling that province govern the complacent, the apathetic, and the disaffected. Let me be the one to say that the emperor has no clothes. Democracy has failed in Alberta. In Greater Canada, we have a minority of representatives representing a minority of our voters running the country like a private club. Opposition parties hesitate to bring down Harper's little fiefdom for fear that he will win a majority and rule without restraint. As long as Harper lacks that majority of members of Parliament, he dare not enact the most outrageous of his planned legislation, in fear of bringing the opposition together to unseat him and bring on an election. But he will provoke an election where, whenever his precious majority could be won. And how would he win a majority of seats in Parliament? In the inevitable election, he will come across to Canadians revealing his, will he come across to Canadians revealing his true plans for changes to our nation? Not bloody likely. Harper will bring in the same folks now orchestrating the McCain campaign in the States. With slick advertising and slander, they will pander to the fears and greed of the lumpen. With buckets of money from their wealthy patrons, the Conservatives will work the voters in vulnerable ridings. We'll be bombarded with advertising attacking their opponents while avoiding commitments of their own. This election will swing on emotion, not policies. In essence, I venture to say, democracy is likewise failing to serve Canada. One freedom that still exists to a remarkable degree is a freedom of information. People of other nations can learn what purported democracy has brought to North America. Mexico suffers blatantly stolen elections. The United States had its presidency ripped off with the connivance of a biased Supreme Court. Canada's suffering under a herd of ideologues representing a minority of voters. In all three nations, the working classes see their rights eroded and their real wages falling. Meanwhile, the wealth of the top percent is increasing exponentially, and multinational corporations rule our lives. We profess to be killing Afghans in order to bless them with the benefits of our form of democracy. Can we not understand the reaction of the average Afghan to this generous offer? They already see the future we have planned for them in the men we have installed as our puppets. Karzai is a man who is on the verge of being thrown out of office for corruption exceeding even Afghan standards. We support a police force that is out of control, stealing and extorting from average citizens at every turn. Their army is a farce. Their parliament is a mass of warlords and gangsters squabbling over the spoils of the occupation. Money and aid that we do send to the people rapidly disappears before reaching projects. Is it any wonder that Afghans look to religious leaders for governance? They see that Hezbollah and Hamas can run governments with minimal corruption while actually helping citizens. The Taliban run a strict, fanatically religious organization, but they've shown that they can bring peace and stability. Of what value to them is a vote when their foreign occupiers will assure that their puppets retain real power? Maybe Plato's ideal of a philosopher king isn't such a bad idea in the 21st century. Self-professed conservative governments everywhere keep making the same short-run mistakes, resulting in the same predictable long-term problems. In Canada, since the days of Mulroney, services have been cut so taxes for the rich could be reduced. A couple of decades ago, their solution to rising medical costs was to cut back on training of doctors and nurses. We pay for that today with lineups for the attention of a drastically reduced number of health professionals. Money for infrastructure has been reduced even as aging public facilities deteriorate. Now we have failing bridges and rough roads beaten up by conservative supporters' SUVs. More communities find they have to boil their drinking water. Inadequate septic sewers spew waste into rivers and lakes, closing beaches and fisheries. But I guess that's all right, as it allows governments to give generous repair contracts to their friends for the privatized maintenance. Have our provincial liberal boneheads learned anything from these and similar lessons? Not likely. A while back, they decided to save money by cutting legal aid funds, closing courthouses around the province, and offering buyouts to judges and justices of the peace. The payback today is waiting times for trial on even traffic offenses stretching from 7 months to 10. Remember the phrase, justice delayed is justice denied? Cuts in legal aid led to accused individuals defending themselves, resulting in more court time as judges have to explain procedures to defendants and coax them along. The effect of closing courthouses and eliminating judges was predictable. the usual way of right-wingers to soften up the public for privatization of a government asset or service is to run it into the ground until the people demand a change. Is our justice system being groomed for privatization? This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. I'm pleased to hear that the appointed military commission in Guantanamo will be bringing Osama bin Laden's driver and sometime bodyguard to trial. This will provide an important precedent when George Wanker Bush is finally taken to trial before the International Criminal Court for War Crimes. It will mean that the court can also bring to trial an army of drivers and Secret Service bodyguards who protected the rogue president's precious body from the wrath of his own citizens. When such flunkies are brought to justice, it will be a deterrent to those who serve other war criminals anywhere in the world. Well, I can dream, can't I? Here's another item from the Uncle Don Executive Compensation Desk at CFUR. Freddie Mac, lost half its stock value in 2007 as investors came to realize that a distressing number of the $5 trillion in mortgages owned by or backed by Freddie Mac and its twin, Fannie Mae, were of dubious value. These two agencies were created by government to supply liquidity to the housing market. They were instrumental in inflating the housing bubble with their cheap money policies. They're an odd mixture of government backing and investor ownership of stock. So after such a drastic drop in stock price and an unbelievably large portfolio with a negative net value due to negligent oversight, what did the directors award the CEO of this outfit for his efforts? Richard Syron pocketed nearly $20 million last year, including a bonus of $3.5 million for his sterling leadership. This year, he is guaranteed about $9 million regardless of performance. Way to go, Richard. You may have skinned the stockholders, screwed the economy, but at least you managed to feather your nest in the process. The Federal National Mortgage Association, fondly called Fannie Mae, was created by the U.S. government during the Depression to extend credit to homeowners. It was supposedly privatized in 1968 and ostensibly belongs to shareholders. In 1970, its sister, Federal Home Mortgage Corporation, known as Freddie Mac, was chartered, likewise with private ownership, to spread the business and prevent monopolization of the market for backstopping mortgages. These two mortgage holding and guaranteeing companies are an odd hermaphrodite creations. Chartered by the U.S. federal government and bearing the implicit backing of the faith and credit of their treasury, they're supposedly owned by holders of their stock. Now it appears that these two entities have so many bad investments that their assets are less than their liabilities. By any definition, they're bankrupt. For decades, the U.S. government has protested that these two operations are independent of and not backed by government. Now push has come to shove, and it seems that these two are, indeed, too big to be allowed to fail. The Treasury expects to spend $25 billion preventing their collapse. Considering that both companies were involved in accounting scandals recently, and that their executive compensation has been questionable, will these entities be nationalized to bring them under control? Not on Bush's watch, they won't. Not only will their liabilities be covered by government largesse, but it seems that their stockholders will be also. Usually when a company goes bankrupt, it's the stockholders who bear the brunt, as they only have the residual interest after all debts, wages, and taxes are paid. No residual assets, no stock value. But this would never do under the Republican definition of capitalism. With their philosophy of free enterprise for the poor and socialism for the rich, stockholders must not be made to pay for the failings of corporations. Let the taxpayers shoulder the burden, or, more likely, let the Chinese buy the debt to bail them out. How sweet it is. Over the years, I've lost track of many old friends with whom I was once very close. I found them dropping away as letters remained unanswered. Each year, their Christmas cards returned or not reciprocated. Slowly, that old circle is contracting. I've rationalized this loss of contact. People die. Some people don't use mail anymore. Although long-distance calling is now cheap, my hearing loss makes telephoning awkward at best. I don't enjoy email exchanges. In his later years, my brother became obsessed with renewing contacts with friends and neighbors from long past. He used internet sources like Classmates to find them. He managed to establish a few email exchanges and spent a good deal of time swapping stories about the old days. For his last 2 years before his death, I telephoned him daily. One irritation that he often expressed was over some of the rebuffs he received from those who did not want to deal with him. He was especially galled by one old friend with whom he was very tight after high school, who went on to become a medical doctor. John bombarded him with unreciprocated emails until this erstwhile friend finally sent a curt note saying that he did not have time to keep up with old acquaintances. John was miffed. "Acquaintances," he said. Then he related some of the adventures that they had shared in their wild days. He could not understand how this man could reject him like that after all they had shared. I sometimes felt the same over treatment I received from old friends. I couldn't understand them until recently. I saw the light after John's death when I was contacted by two old neighbors, sisters with whom John had been chatting by email. They had found my email address and were moved to express condolences. Fair enough. I replied politely, but soon found myself involved in lengthy exchanges with both, now living in different parts of the states. We began talking about our current circumstances. Then they lapsed into chat about incidents and neighbors I had not seen nor thought of for almost half a century. After a couple of these time-consuming exchanges, I sent each a brief message saying I didn't remember much about that period of my life. I was not much interested in dredging it up. I'm quite happy with my current circumstances, and I don't care to dwell on the past. Neither one responded, and I feel no great loss. So the shoe was on the other foot, and I can see how it feels to be on the receiving end of unwanted contacts from the past. I'd assumed that my returned or unreciprocated letters were due to negligence, changed addresses, or, more commonly as time goes on, death. Maybe these people feel about me and our shared history as I did about these two women from the dim past. Maybe those friendships that you now feel will last forever are not so permanent. Life goes on, circumstances change, and so, too, do people. My brother's pursuit of friends from the past was fueled by his lack of a present. I'm now more willing to let old relationships slip away as long as I have an active present and am making new friends as I carom through life. Washington State ferries have instituted tighter security on their ships. Their state patrol is playing with a program whereby they use a license plate reader tied into state records. Their automatic license plate recognition system compares passenger plates with lists of stolen vehicles, outstanding warrants for registered owners, and the Department of Homeland Paranoia's terror watch list. They're spinning their wheels when it comes to actual security. Sure, they will grab some wanted individuals and harass those with names similar to the ones on Bush's shit list, but their professed concern for terrorism is missed entirely. If an individual of average intelligence were intent on creating mayhem on a Washington ferry, would he use a car registered in the name of a felon or known terror suspect? Maybe such a person would have the sense to borrow from an innocent, or perhaps rent a car for his deeds. This is not an anti-terror exercise. It's another turn of the screw for invasion of personal privacy. Those lists of license plates stored in some remote computer bank will be useful to anyone putting together a profile for whatever purpose of the movements of an individual. Travel information will be one more building block in the massive amount of data available to one with access to the trail of information we leave behind. In a few hours, a profile on you can be assembled whereby interested parties can know more about you than your closest friends do. Those who are not hermits leave a broad trail through life. All of the following can be mined by officials or those able to hack into computer data banks: telephone and hydro bills, school transcripts, credit and debit card usage, store affinity programs, tax records, employment records, bank records, passports, air miles, and others. Once coming to official notice, you can be subject, without your knowledge, to mail and email surveillance, telephone tapping, internet usage, and plain old bugging. Are we paranoid if we worry about such intrusions into our privacy? A common response is, "I have nothing to hide." Well, ask someone who lived in East Germany, where the Stasi had the world's largest system of surveillance and spying on its own citizens. Everyone had to take care not to do or say anything that might bring them to official attention. No conversation was confidential. No friendship could be trusted. After the wall fell and Stasi records opened to the public, one man found that his spouse had been spying on him. Close friends and co-workers were exposed. The whole rotten network was revealed to a nation of victims. I wonder if our networks will ever be uncovered. Will we ever find the sources of information that put 1 million Americans and untold Canadians on official watch lists and no-fly lists? What safeguards exist to stop the creep toward that total information awareness program that the U.S. government was working to implement? Ah, but it can't happen in Canada. Yeah, right. British Columbia Ferries is already looking at increased security on its ships, and that may well feed government data banks, just like those of our counterparts in Washington State. A pillar of international law is the prohibition of collective punishment. Accepted law forbids penalizing individuals for acts that they did not personally commit. It also forbids targeting civilians. Israel has committed many violations of this law, the latest being the threatened demolition of homes belonging to two Palestinians behind recent attacks on Israelis. These men are dead and cannot be punished, but their surviving relatives can be rendered homeless by actions approved by Israel's Attorney General. This is a minor affair considering in the light of the massive collective punishment meted out to Palestinians in general for having the audacity to elect a Hamas government. Gaza is an open-air prison hemmed in on all sides, ruled by Israel. Israel is using the same tactics that Reagan used to crush the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, make the citizens' lives so miserable they will vote as their tormentor wishes them, just to ease the pain. The analogy with torture is obvious. The population of Iran is being subjected to sanctions and threats of massive attack for having the audacity to, purportedly, work toward building nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, Israel receives unconditional support for its every action, including blatant violations of international law, while possessing its very real atomic bombs. Hypocrisy uber alles. Blackwater Worldwide, Bush's shadow army of mercenaries, announced that it will shift its business away from contracting for security in war zones. Oh yes, it will continue to guard American officials in Iraq, but will no longer field killers like the ones now operating with impunity in that unfortunate land. From now on, say Blackwater officials, they will concentrate on training, aviation, and logistics. As to training, aviation, and logistics, we shall see how the company defines those functions. Blackwater founder and radical right-wing religious fundamentalist Eric Prince said to the press, "The experience we've had would certainly be a disincentive to any other companies that want to step in and put their entire business at risk." Bullshit. Blackwater was billing the U.S. government around $900 a day for each mercenary in the field, while paying those killers about $200. Well, I guess the rest is just miscellaneous overhead and a wee bit of profit. I don't believe for a minute that Blackwater will withdraw from such a rich field of enterprise. He may redefine the roles of these men and that equipment they have assembled, but they will continue to supply killers for hire to the highest bidder. One of my regular reads is Alberta Views. An article in the March issues contains the following gem: government does not empower citizens, and the government that suggests it does is arrogant and ignorant. Citizens empower government, and citizens can disempower governments. From time to time, citizens should disempower their government. The social contract is among citizens. Government is not a party to the social contract. It is the result, the product of the social contract. This has been the 277th edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Your host is Uncle Don. Tune in to CGLY and CHLS, rebroadcast in Nelson, Kootenai Lake, and Lillooet.